Behold, beloved listeners, the 18th century, the age of enlightenment, of revolution, of commerce, of globalization. It was the century of British imperialism, as the indigenous people of this and other continents know all too well. Now, at school, you learnt about the brave explorers who travelled the seas looking for adventure, new territory and trading opportunities. But what was the perspective of the British Empire of those indigenous people they encountered, conquered and decimated? Now, we're finally starting to hear those perspectives. And tonight, we'll hear the stories of two fascinating characters, not from our neck of the woods, but from other countries that felt the wrath of the, quote, black pipe of the British Empire. Black pipe, the phrase that Mai used to describe the British guns that killed so many people on the island of Tahiti. We'll meet him and Ostenaco, a Cherokee warrior. And the third character is the one that binds them, portrait painter Joshua Reynolds. He painted them both while they were in England in the second half of the 18th century. And the person who tells us this fascinating tale of three very different blokes is Kate Fulliker. Kate is a professor of history at the Institute of Humanities and Social Sciences at the Australian Catholic University. She's also the author of The Warrior, The Voyager and The Artist, Three Lives in the Age of Empire, published by Yale University Press. Welcome to the program, Kate, and congratulations. You're the winner of the New South Wales History Prize.
Thanks very much, Philip. Thanks for having me.
And this all began when you were thinking about doing a bio of Joshua Reynolds.
That's right. Yes, I had thought that my next book would be about Reynolds, who, of course, is in some ways, you know, a canonical famous white man, but has actually been owned so much by art historians that not many cultural historians like me had ventured into writing about him. But then when I started researching him, and I was particularly interested in the fact that he had an obvious interest in depicting non-European people, particularly Indigenous people of the empire, and not many people had talked about that. And then the two sitters that I was most interested in, Ostenaco and Mai, you just talked about, then appeared to me as having just about as much biographical material on them as Reynolds himself did, oddly enough, I mean, against most of my colleagues' expectations. And then when I realised that all three men were pretty much living parallel lives, relatively similar age span through the 18th century, I thought that kind of three biographies of the global 18th century would be more interesting even than just talking about Reynolds.
Now, talking about navigation and bold voyages, how do you navigate the life of a man like Ostenaco or Mai when the resources and records are written by the colonisers?
That's right. I mean, it's definitely true that I didn't find any particular kind of a magic way around that. And most of the sources do come from colonial and therefore very kind of compromised sources. But I think that for too long historians thought that this presented too much of a problem to write a biography of any Indigenous person in the 18th century. I mean, Indigenous peoples don't generally get biographies for the 18th century because there is such an assumption that it can't be grasped.
Well, as you point out, it's better to use these sources rather than not write at all.
That's right. I kind of thought that actually that there was still enough to say, enough for them to come out through the sources and to illuminate something to us, that it would be better than not talking to them about them at all. And the more, of course, I thought about the problematic sources for the Indigenous characters, which, you know, still told us more than I think we expected, the more you realise that, of course, the plentiful resources on someone like Joshua Reynolds were almost, you know, as equally compromised, really. I mean, that they are still have the compromises of 2.5 centuries of kind of intermediaries on them as well. So we kind of, when you talk about any 18th century figure, you soon realise that they're all as sort of a little bit less than you would have hoped, but more than perhaps we've assumed.
Let's begin with the Appalachian Cherokee Ostenaco.
Yes. Yeah. So he is the he's the slightly older one of the three men, and he is particularly interesting because he's born at the early beginning of the 18th century and dies in the middle of the American Revolution. So through his life as a quite esteemed leader of the Cherokee, you can see a story of the Cherokee throughout the whole century, and that's one of the reasons why I was interested in him. He's as a warrior through kind of various historical circumstances. He also has to become a diplomat, and then he becomes a diplomat with other Indian nations, with the French and with the British. So really, by the time he goes to Britain in the 1760s, where he meets Reynolds and a whole bunch of kind of luminous people in London at the time, he is a pretty well-seasoned diplomat, you know, as seasoned, if not maybe even more so, than the kind of British people he's meeting in the Appalachians.
Let's walk him back a little bit and make the point that Cherokees track their lineage through their mother's line. It's a matrilineal society.
That's right. Yes, that's right. So, you know, imagining his earlier life, which has got the least sources, was the most challenging. So what I did there was to try and think about proxies that we might know of other Cherokees living in the earlier 18th century. The overriding theme of the Cherokee society then and now is that it is matrilineal, which is not necessarily to say it's matriarchal. It's not necessarily all power is not held by matriarchs, but kinship lines are run through women. And so thinking about Ostenaco's mother, of which we only have very, very limited sources, but a little bit, was the way that I kind of began imagining Ostenaco's life, thinking about his mother's line, which determines so much more of his life than someone like his father would have, or any uncle or brother or and so on. And thinking about the fact that he lived in a matrilineal society, but not necessarily a matriarchal. So we thought about the different ways that power worked in Cherokee society actually made me realize how much, even more deeply, how much British society at the time was so male dominated. It was so particularly patrilineal and patriarchal that it is actually stands out as quite unusual in the 18th century world as being much more male dominated than many other societies at the time.
Kate, you make the point that Cherokees were avengers but not plunderers, which made it difficult for them to understand the English. You just seemed to want to kill as many people as they could. And yes, he was a very successful warrior, but as you tell us, most of the battles would have been against other tribes, not the English.
That's right. Most of the time, I mean, he would have defined his life as a warrior, but it was interesting to me, and this is why I particularly liked taking on the biographical method for thinking about an indigenous life, because, you know, at the end of his life, if I imagined him kind of recounting the tale of his own story, he would have thought that many more engagements, many more defining moments in his life would have been within Cherokee society or Cherokee and other Indigenous nations, which was a nice kind of background perspective for me to think about the impact of empire. You know, of course, through the 18th century, European empires have, of course, an unmistakable impact. But looking at them through the biographical lens reminds us that it's still Indigenous terms by which they kind of define their own life, by which they make meaning, that you can still imagine this world through an Indigenous frame of reference.
Okay, let's look at his career as a diplomat. You make the point that when he was a child, six Cherokees went to Britain to sign a document of friendship with
That's
the
right.
goal from the British of uniting the tribes under one banner. That never worked.
No, it didn't work as it was called a treaty of friendship and commerce, and it certainly made the British think that, you know, that they'd got this tribe wrapped up and would not cause any problems in the future. But of course, the Cherokee just thought this was an alliance mainly about trade, which they could then use to maybe, you know, leverage with their with the British rivals, the French. You know, so it was much more of a kind of a workaday trading document for which they could kind of constantly have to renew and renegotiate it. So, but interesting, I think it's interesting that Ostenaco had an example in his own life of he knew that some people had ventured even as far across the Atlantic to maintain their diplomatic worlds. And so when he did it, it wasn't, you know, for him, it wouldn't have not been like going to the moon or anything bizarre. It would have been just an extension of his indigenous world.
Okay, we'll have to sort of blur over some of this to, because of our time limitations, but
sure.
After some terrible trouble with the French as well as the English, Ostenaco has to deal with the fact that a Cherokee delegation was executed by the British.
That's right. There was the Cherokee had been involved in what the Europeans would call the Seven Years' War through the 50s and 60s of the 18th century, and by the end of it, the British and the Cherokee had turned against each other and blown into full blown war, and there was a terrible hostage situation, which had ended in the massacre of around about 22 Cherokee people, which really turned Ostenaco, who had at various occasions worked as a warrior, a kind of ally to the British, but it really turned him against them. So he had a very kind of bitter Cherokee Anglo war. But at the end of it, the British were triumphant, and they, sought peace terms. Now Ostenaco goes to London in order to sort of cement that peace treaty, and which, you know, he doesn't go as a, you know, unforgiving enemy of the British, but he goes as a very wary person who has now suffered through 2 years of fighting the British. So in some ways, I think that, he's resuming his diplomatic mode after being in warrior mode. He goes there very, very determined to make sure the peace is really, really secure. And that's why he goes all the way to meet George III, in fact, and they have a couple of meetings. And partly not because he's so bedazzled by the idea of being defeated by the British, but because he's really wants to make sure that such a war would never happen again.
This is Alan Earl on Radio National, and my guest is Kate Fuliger, who's Professor of History and the Institute of Humanities and Social Sciences at that fine institution, the Australian Catholic University. Now, tell us about Mai, or as he's sometimes known as Oh Mai.
That's right. Yes, in 18th century Britain, he would have been called Oh Mai. It's interesting that some Pacific Islanders today still call him by this name, partly in kind of in deference to his fame that he achieved in the 18th century. And he was about a generation or so younger than Ostenaco, but tracked a reasonably similar life. I mean, he goes to Britain as a much younger man and not as a formal diplomat, but he does go in some capacity as a diplomat. Certainly James Cook, who took him over there, assumed that he might be a future diplomat with or a negotiator with the British Empire if they ever wanted to claim some Pacific Islands for sovereignty. He himself probably is motivated by, if not kind of national or tribal motivations, he is motivated for his own familial kind of kinship reasons to see if he can claim some British assistance in his own kind of inter-Indigenous conflicts that are going on around the Tahitian archipelago where he's from.
What's Mai's first contact with the Brits?
Well, his first contact would have been with Samuel Wallace's arrival in Tahiti, and that's when he experiences for the first time, as you said at the beginning, the black pipes, which turn out to be those deadly muskets. So he sees through Wallace's encounter with Tahiti, and Wallace is the first European to arrive in Tahiti, quickly followed by Bougainville. He sees in that encounter, of course, a lot of mayhem and bloodshed, but it's interesting that that's not the only thing that he's concluding. What he's concluding is these could be people who might be usefully used for my own local purposes and my own local conflicts with other Indigenous rivals. So he misses the Bougainville voyage, we think. There's no evidence that he meets the Bougainville voyage. But 2 years after Wallace had turned up in Tahiti, James Cook arrives. And he definitely meets them, even though James Cook can't quite remember him in his memoirs. And then when James Cook turns up for the second time, Mai wastes no time in jumping on board, ingratiating himself with the captain, because he wants to get on board and go home to this empire and find out what kind of arms and manpower he might attract from them.
He's taken straight to Whitehall and handed over to the Earl of Sandwich.
That's right, yes, who at the time was head of the Navy and therefore kind of formally Cook's boss. But Sandwich knew that Joseph Banks was eagerly waiting at home, wanting someone like Mai to come back from the Pacific. Banks had kind of I mean, it's hard to pinpoint a scientist's interest, Enlightenment scientist's interest in examining what he would have called a South Seas, you know, specimen. But Banks undeniably also had half of a kind of proto-imperialist interest in thinking, what could we make of a possible negotiator if Britain ever wants to make a move into the Pacific? We need these kind of negotiators on the ground.
There's some marvellous stuff here. On his first day, he's taken to meet the boss, the king.
Yep.
And he asks for gunpowder to be removed from the border of Borden's and his island. He cooks for the Earl of Sandwich, who, of course, is famous for food. He didn't cook a sandwich, though, did he?
No, he doesn't cook a sandwich, although that's apparently what sandwiches are famous for. He cooks it with what would say in Aotearoa, a hangi, you know, at a kind of an underground oven, and he cooks a beautiful piece of mutton, I think it is, and the comments are, you know, this is as fine as a gourmand in Paris would find this food. This is amazing food. He brings to Britain all these extraordinary skills. And that happens over and over again through Mai's 2 years in Britain. The people are pretty much kind of bedazzled by him. He clearly was a very charming young man, even if his own kind of motivations was not necessarily to charm these British people, but to, you know, actually kind of target people like Sandwich, the head of the Navy, to give him arms, to give him alliance with his own battles back home.
Going back to Banks's view, he really was a live specimen. In fact, Banks had him inoculated against smallpox. Now, let us move to Joshua. Probably not quite as colourful as Ostenaco or Mai, but tell us about Josh.
There was an interesting challenge actually writing about them, that, you know, I would sort of alternate between the chapter, each kind of man has a chapter each, and then it kind of alternates through the book. And writing about the two Indigenous peoples was writing about men of action, you know, really kind of keeping up with all their doings. And then Joshua is the artist, who sometimes, it is always hard to write about artists, particularly visual artists, if your medium is words. So one way I tried to bring Joshua Reynolds to life, who is in any way a much more circumspect person, was to actually try and think of his personality, his wishes, his desires through his avowed friendships with two much more flamboyant people of the 18th century. And his two great friends were Samuel Johnson and Edmund Burke, who, of course, were not particularly friends with each other. But it was undeniable that Reynolds was very connected to both Johnson and Burke. And it was through an examination of his friendships with them that I managed to kind of think about what was the kind of the politics of what were Reynolds' politics? What was his views about the empire that was going on around him? Why would he have sought out both Ostenaco and Mai to paint?
Well, you see, the answer to all these questions involves reading your book, and I urge the listeners to so do. But I have to ask you this. Young Joshua wanted to be a fizzmonger. What on earth was that?
Fizzmonger, wonderful phrase from the 18th century, a beautiful kind of early 18th century phrase, face seller, right? A real nod to the fact that when Joshua's coming up as a young man, being a portraitist was like being an artisan that you needed an apprenticeship for, just as if you would be a carpenter or any other kind of trade. And it was actually Reynolds will probably be most famous in the end for being a leading light in the transformation of portraiture or portrait painters out of the kind of the world of artisan and into the world of art. And he is part of that creation that we still live with today, that painters of any type are artists who work for something above money, they have a propensity to genius, they're kind of the intangible, romantic. Reynolds is part of creating that kind of myth that we have still.
Now, we know that Ostenaco lived a long life and that Mai returns, gets home, but he dies pretty young.
That's right, yes. So it's interesting that both Ostenaco and Mai make it back to their homelands. In a previous work, I've looked at a whole bunch of these Indigenous peoples who can travel to, who managed to travel to Europe through the 17th, early 18th, 19th centuries. And so many of them do not make it back, mainly because of the pathogen problem that they are going to encounter when they when they change worlds. But Austin Arco probably had a reasonably robust immune system because he'd already been part of a European intermingling when he was in North America. And Mai, of course, was inoculated. So they both survive.
And what about Josh? Did he make old bones?
He died around about the age of 69, 70, which in his age would have been reasonably respectable, although both his friends, Johnson and Burke, did live longer than that. Yes, but he, of course, would have had the toughest immune system of all three of the men. So back to Austin Arco and Mai. Austin Arco, relatively long-lived. He dies in the middle of the American Revolution, not from war, but probably from one of the smallpox epidemics that run through North America through the American Revolution. Mai also dies in the middle of local battles and kind of an inter-Indigenous battle, but again, probably not from war directly, but probably from a kind of a disease that would have ripped through Tahiti at the time.
Well, Kate, you've done them all proud. Kate Dillinger, Professor of History at the Institute of Humanities and Social Sciences at the Australian Catholic University. The book, The Warrior, The Voyager and The Artist, Three Lives in the Age of Empire, published by New Haven. It's not only won the New South Wales History Prize, it's just won a koala stamp. Good on you, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me.